Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, remembering the smiling Pope. With this weekend marking the anniversary of the election of Albino Luciani as Pope John Paul I, we look back and find out why he made such an impact during his brief papacy. And previewing the Paralympics. It's less than a week to the start of the London 2012 Paralympic Games, and we hear more about the local Catholic Church's preparations and expectations concerning this unique sporting event.
Habemus Papam. Eminentissimum ac reverendissimum Dominum Albinum Sancte Romane Ecclesiae Cardinalem Luciani.
It was August the 26th, 1978, the year which has gone down in recent history as the year of the three popes. After one of the shortest conclaves ever held, the cardinal electors had chosen the then Patriarch of Venice, Cardinal Albino Luciani, to head the See of Peter. He was the first pope to take the names of both of his immediate predecessors, John the 23rd and Paul the 6th, whose death had occurred earlier that same month. It also marked the first time that a pope had chosen to take a double name.
Devo cercare di servire la Chiesa.
But who was Pope John Paul I? And what impact did he have during his brief papacy? Born in the northeastern Veneto region of Italy, Albino Luciani was the son of a poor labourer. At an early age, he decided to become a priest, and after more than 30 years of service in the church, was appointed Patriarch of Venice in 1969. Less than 4 years later, he was given a cardinal's hat by Pope Paul VI. He was elected to the papacy when aged 65. During his 33 days as pope, John Paul I quickly won over the crowds with his personal warmth and open manner, and became known as the Smiling Pope.
Ieri mattina io son andato alla Sistina a votare.
On the day after his election, during his Angelus address to the crowds jammed into St. Peter's Square, Pope John Paul I revealed how he went along calmly to the conclave to vote. Never, he said, had he expected the outcome that occurred, and that he would be the one chosen to be the next pope.
Appena è cominciato il pericolo per me.
He drew laughs from the crowd when he spoke of how, during the balloting, he soon saw, as he put it, the danger approaching him, and described how two fellow cardinals whispered words of support and encouragement to him.
Se il Signore dà un peso, darà anche l'aiuto per portarlo.
The late Cardinal William Baum of Washington later described to Vatican Radio the special quality of Pope Albino Luciani's 33-day rule.
His pontificate, although brief, was, from our point of view, a moment of grace. The world reacted with great joy to the election of John Paul I. I remember that with great satisfaction. Immediately, the world embraced him. He had that ability to communicate, even without words. I believe that's correct. He again appeared to everyone as the great, what he was, as a very loving father.
Given the popularity of the new pope and the fact that he was only in his mid-60s, it came as a huge shock to everyone. when he suddenly died one night, barely a month after his election. Not surprisingly, people reacted with total disbelief when, for the second time that summer, the bells of St. Peter tolled for the death of a pope. One of those who couldn't believe the news at first was the late U.S. Cardinal John Foley, who told us how he reacted on being told that the new pope had died.
Well, I had a great sense of disbelief. I remember I was at home and somebody knocked at my door at 4 a.m. and said, "The pope died." And I said, "I know the pope died. You know, they elected a new one a month ago." And they said, "No, that pope died." You know, I couldn't believe it.
Similar disbelief came from Cardinal Baum when he was told the news of Pope John Paul I's untimely passing.
One of my priests called me. It was about 2:30, 2:45 in the morning. And he wakened me from a dead sleep. And he said, "I'm sorry to call you, but I think you should know the pope has died." And my first reaction is, "You're mistaken. You must have been listening to a program about the death of Pope Paul VI.
"Dear sons and daughters, your presence is a great joy for me because I love you all very much."
George Weigel is a U.S. Catholic scholar and Vatican expert and the biographer of Pope John Paul II. I phoned Weigel up to ask him to share with us his own memories of Pope Luciani and help us shed some more light on the figure of the man who touched the hearts of so many during his brief time as head of the Catholic Church.
"Love is like a journey in which we run."
I think the first reaction that I and many others had at the election of Cardinal Luciani as John Paul I was how quickly it was done. This was one of the most rapid conclaves in history. There obviously was a consensus in favor of Cardinal Luciani that had formed between the death of Pope Paul VI and the immurement of the conclave. And those who were expecting a more protracted electoral process were the first surprised people. Secondly, I think it's fair to say that Cardinal Luciani was not particularly well known in the church in the United States, for sure. And the initial self-presentation of this man, a holy, smiling, self-confident pastor, did a great deal to dissipate the fog that seemed to have settled over the church in the first 8 years of the 1970s. He was like a ray of sun, and I think was very well received because of that.
Yes, I mean, in fact, he quickly became known as the smiling pope. He very much impressed people, didn't he, with this very genuine and personal warmth and his candor as well, the way he spoke in his speeches.
He was a man not unlike the present pope, Benedict XVI, in that he was a brilliant catechist. He was a man who had an ability to express the enduring truths of Catholic faith in an accessible way, using examples and illustrations that made sense to people who didn't necessarily have much theological training or even catechetical formation. And at a time in the history of the church when catechetical work had fallen on hard times, when religious education was not in particularly good shape, when there were a lot of questions about whether it was in fact possible to make the Christian offer, to make the Christian proposal in a way that made sense, the month-long pontificate of John Paul I demonstrated that you could do that, and that you could do it particularly effectively if it was done with a smile, if it was done with a sense of Christian joy.
He was quite a trailblazer in his own way because, for instance, he was the first pope to speak in the singular form using the I form instead of the more regal we. And he was also the first pope to reject the traditional papal coronation with a tiara, opting instead for a more simplified papal inauguration mass. What does all this say about him to us?
I think it says that he was part of a process that had been going on, in fact, I believe, since Leo XIII, in which the papacy was being redefined as an office of witness, an office of evangelism, much less an office of management, and still less an office of power as the world understands power. Beginning with Leo XIII, the popes begin to deploy a new form of power, the power of moral argument. And I think Cardinal Luciani had the intuition that the tiara symbolized an older expression of the papacy that was fading from the historical scene and that was really not necessary to symbolically represent the essence of the office. The essence of the office lay in the role of the Pope as teacher and witness to the truth of God in Christ.
He also admitted openly in public that the prospect of the papacy was hugely daunting for him. He actually had to be almost nudged into, well, getting the courage for it. And he also said he had no idea when he went to the conclave that this was in store for him. So quite a modest man, presumably.
Well, any sane person finds the prospect of the papacy daunting. It's a job that in many respects is too large for anyone. And you'll remember the remarkable homily of John Paul II, then Cardinal Wojtyła, on the death of John Paul I. When Wojtyła, the Polish cardinal, preaching at the Polish college in Rome, took as his text the three questions of the risen Lord to Peter, do you love me, do you love me, do you love me more than the rest of these, and speaks of this as a terrifying set of questions posed to any pope. Can you empty yourself of yourself so completely that you are the instrument of the divine purpose as no one else is? That's a really hard set of questions to face. And as I say, I think anyone who understands the nature of the office of Peter in the church finds it incredibly daunting and something that can only be approached in a spirit of humility and prayer.
And it is about love that I want to speak to you today. Love.
In his general audiences and his Angelus addresses and the few speeches he made as Pope, he spoke a lot about Christian love, didn't he?
Well, he was a man who understood that the church had come to be taken by the world as a naysayer, as an institution that was constantly saying no to this, no to that. Now, the church has to say no on many occasions, but as John Paul II and Benedict XVI have insisted, John Paul I also understood that the church's no to whatever is always based on a yes, and that yes is the affirmation of God's infinite love for the world, manifest in Christ the Lord and Redeemer. Sometimes it seems we're not too good at articulating the yes that makes the no make sense. And in some respects, John Paul I's brief pontificate, those 33 September days of 1978, were a powerful reminder that its challenge to modern culture, to modern society, to modern lifestyles, always has to be rooted in the love of God manifest in Christ, which calls us to a noble and loving form of life.
Pope Albino Luciani decided to call himself after both of his predecessors' names, John from Pope John XXIII and Paul from Pope Paul VI, of course. And this was a decision copied by his successor, Pope John Paul II. Do you know why the former Cardinal Wojtyła chose the same name as his predecessor?
I think it was to underscore the continuity of the office. There was a tremendous shock throughout the world church and throughout the College of Cardinals at the death of John Paul I after 33 days. Cardinal William Baum, then the Archbishop of Washington, told me that it was a terrible psychological blow, a spiritual blow to these cardinal electors who, as Cardinal Baum put it to me, really believed that they had done the will of God in electing Cardinal Luciani as John Paul I, and that if he were taken so quickly, as the cardinal put it, God was saying something to us. So there was a sense of shock and institutional instability. I think John Paul II's decision to take the name of his immediate predecessor, who had taken the names of his two immediate predecessors, was quite simply an attempt to demonstrate that the office remained intact, that the role of Peter in the church would continue, and that the church would move forward from this surprising moment of 33-day papacy.
Now, talking of course, this surprising death and everything, there were, of course, all the conspiracy theories about his sudden death, that he was murdered. I mean, do you think the church was somewhat baffled by all that?
I think what the church should have learned from all of that is that it is important to know the medical conditions, the health conditions of possible candidates for the papacy. This man who clearly, in retrospect, had serious circulatory problems that were sooner or later going to have the lethal effect that they did 33 days into his papacy, that these things should not have been recognized and attended to. I think that's the lesson from serious journalistic inquiries into the death of John Paul I, which I think have exploded the conspiracy theories, but have underscored a rather dramatic lack of competent medical attention at the time of his election and throughout the months of his papacy.
So, if you had to sum up in one or two sentences this very brief papacy of Pope John Paul I, how would it be?
I would say that he was part of a century-long transition in the office of the papacy from a regal and managerial office to an evangelical and pastoral office. I would say that in that brief month, he showed the joy and love that is at the heart of Christian life in a way that the church had perhaps not demonstrated throughout the 1970s, which were a very difficult time of contention inside the church. And I think, frankly, the shock of his death created the human conditions for the possibility of the election of a non-Italian, which is, of course, what happened in the election of Karol Wojtyła as John Paul II.
I was speaking to George Weigel, Vatican expert and biographer.
L'amore sarà sempre vittorioso. L'amore può tutto.
It's less than a week before the start of the London 2012 Paralympics, which will see a record 4,200 athletes, all with some form of disability, competing in the 11-day games. For the first time in the history of the Paralympics, all the advance tickets have been sold out for this inspirational sporting event. Monsignor John Armitage is the Vicar General of the Diocese of Brentwood, which includes the area of East London where the Games are taking place. He's one of the chaplains at the Paralympics and also carried out this same role during the London Olympic Games. He spoke to me about his hopes and expectations for the Paralympics. How many masses a day are you planning to hold during the Paralympics? And also, how many chaplains will there be during the Paralympics?
Well, we had three a day for the Olympics. We're not going to have as many because there aren't as many people there, actually, in the Olympic Village. So we're looking to have two masses. We have an early mass at 7:30 in the morning and a 5 o'clock mass in the evening. But apart from that, it's going to be pretty much the same. We have five Catholic priests who will be working in different shifts. We will start at 7 o'clock in the morning, through till 2 in the afternoon, and then from 2 till 10. And we work with people of other faiths and other denominations. In the Olympic Games, we had about 20 in a shift. Now, there'll be a rabbi, an imam, and a Buddhist monk, and a Hindu priest, and various people from other Christian groups. So we all work together, although there are, you know, completely separate places for the provision of individual worship.
How would you describe the atmosphere in the Olympic Village during the Games?
Well, of course, the point of the village is it is meant to be the home for the athletes. And so you have a totally different atmosphere from what's going outside. In Stratford and in London, you know, you've had hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people just turning up to go to the games or just turning up to experience the atmosphere. But for the athletes, they need a place where they can step back, where they can be just have somewhere where there's no pressure from cameras. So there are no interviews done for the athletes in the Olympic villages, and only very, very limited access for the media. So it's a place where they can just go and relax. And the accommodation is basic but comfortable, but the area is very pleasant. It's been very, very well laid out. And the object is that the houses in which they're in will be lived in by local people when the Olympics and the Paralympics are all finished.
What for you is the greatest and most inspirational thing about the Paralympics?
Well, I think one of the issues about the whole Olympic movement is that it's now very, very big. You know, it's a massive organisation, and always where you have such big events, sometimes, you know, the heart of it can get lost. But I think there were many concerns about the Games, particularly for the Olympics, on the run-up to the Olympics, which very few materialised. It was a real fabulous success. But the real success, and I think what is most inspiring, which we saw with the Olympics, and I think we'll see much more in the Paralympics, is just the sheer dedication and sacrifice of so many people, particularly young people from around the world. And you know, the British press is always a bit cynical. You know, for 2 weeks we had nothing but talking about, you know, the real strong values of sacrifice and determination and hard work. Almost every athlete who won paid tribute to their parents and the importance of family life in supporting them. So the real thing that's the most inspiring is not the big buildings. We've got some wonderful buildings in London. But it really was the way, the determination and the sacrifice of these young people who made these buildings, as grand as they are, really come to life. That's what we saw in the Olympics. And there's a big sign up in London at the moment that says, thank you for the warm-up. And so the Paralympics sort of looked at the Olympics as the big warm-up for what they consider will be the main event. I'm sure the Paralympics, which has had probably the biggest sales of any Paralympic Games, over 2 million people have bought tickets for the Paralympics in London so far, and it's completely sold out. And again, I think it's not just because of the building. The site's pretty wonderful. It is to come and see these people, particularly the young, perform in such a remarkable way and with such generosity.
And that's quite unusual, isn't it, that they've managed to sell all the tickets? Because I've heard from other people that sometimes in past Paralympics they've had to give away the tickets because there simply
wasn't the interest.
Yes.
Well, I think one of the fruits of the Olympics going well is that people who couldn't get tickets for the Olympics wanted to come and see the Paralympics. And I think what they'll see is something as good, possibly even better, in terms of the spirit.
So there's no worry about people not treating the Paralympic Games with the same sort of amount of enthusiasm as the Olympics and really, you know, supporting these athletes?
No, I think the actual athletes will get tremendous. It will be smaller, inevitably, because it's not as big as the Olympics and not as many countries participate. But certainly, I think what we'll see is a real respect for this level of competition among people with some form of disability.
And what would you say is the key theme of the Paralympics from the point of view of the Catholic Church?
Well, I suppose one of the important things about the Church is that we try to be as inclusive as possible, and particularly in the areas of trying to get people who very often are not mainstream in society, particularly health-wise. And I think this is one of the great things about being pro-life. Pro-life very often is talked about in terms of our support for the unborn child, which is absolutely essential. But pro-life is much broader than just that particular but very important aspect of the Church's teaching. Pro-life is actually being able to bring in to the mainstream, anyone who's on the margins, anyone who doesn't necessarily feel that they're part of the main life. What the church tries to do, and I think we have a very long tradition, particularly in this country, of trying to bring people who are disabled into some form of engagement. Now, that's particularly done by every diocese in England and Wales, and Scotland as well, would have a major diocesan pilgrimage to Lourdes. One of our big pilgrimages, the Handicapped Children's Pilgrimage Trust, takes thousands to Lourdes every year. This is a very big part of Catholic life. It's our support for those young people, not so young people, who are disabled in some way, to be given something very special in recognition of the important part that they play. That's something that we do as a Catholic community on a day-to-day basis. Many parishes would have different clubs for disabled people and a whole range of activities to try and integrate people as best as they can. One of the things we've done in preparation for the Paralympics has been we held a conference in Westminster Central Hall on sport, theology and disability. And we had over 150 people turn up, and this was an international conference, to look and to see how people with different disabilities can be integrated into the life, not just of the church, but of society. So we've played, so far, a very significant role in terms of what happens in our parishes and our schools, but always we can do better. And I think that the drive that will come from the Paralympics will help not just the church, but society to recognise and celebrate people, whatever their disability. And I think the Paralympics will move things forward in a very significant way for both church and society.
And if it was coming to a sort of more overall legacy for both the Olympics and the Paralympics, what for you will be the greatest legacy?
I think you have the legacy of buildings, and that's very significant. This is a very poor part of London, and certainly there has been regeneration. Personally, I feel that the Olympic Games produced a great spirit within the country. Now, part of that, I think, was that we won lots of medals, and that was all very well and good. As the host country, that's always a good thing to happen. But I do think it also gave a great lift to the country. I mean, these are difficult economic times, but certainly the impact, particularly of the opening ceremony, on ordinary people was quite phenomenal. And then from that, to go on and to be able to see such great events live in the midst of our own community has given a real lift. So legacy, yes, the buildings are there, but I think it's probably helped us in the UK to have a celebration of where we are at this particular moment in history. And the opening ceremony, as you know, which involved Majesty the Queen, was a real pleasant surprise for all of us who saw it. And I think a country that can put on an opening ceremony as we did here in the UK in such a way, I think you can say that's a good legacy for us to take forward. It shows that, you know, we are a British society, but a very multi-ethnic society. But, you know, a strong sense of our British identity celebrated by people who their origins may not be from Britain, but who now are part of British society. And I think that that's given us a particular strength and something really to celebrate.
I was speaking to Monsignor John Armitage, Vicar General of the Diocese of Brentwood. Well, that's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English programme. But we hope you have enjoyed listening to us. We'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow. And don't forget, you can always find our programmes at the click of a mouse on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.